Well, good evening and welcome to the Digital Finance Analytics live stream for Tuesday, the 21st of May, 2019. Great to have you on board, and it's really good to see the numbers really rising. I guess this is very much a critical time in the property sector with everything that's there today. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, of course, is here, and I'm running the show tonight as normal. We've already got nearly 400 on the stream before we even start, so it's terrific, and I really appreciate all of those who are making the effort to come on tonight. Those who are using Super Chat already, thank you so much. That really is appreciated, and you know, I hope that we'll have a really interesting conversation this evening. What I'm going to do as normal is just go through the introduction and specifically talk about some of the things that will effectively stimulate the conversation tonight. So let me do that straight away. Just to say, I'm going to be looking at the presentation, not the live chat. So at the moment, just put your questions in if you like, but I won't be looking at them for a few minutes. Okay, so here we go. Just in terms of the running order, we'll do this introduction. Well, that's done now, of course. Just quickly on the house rules. About our models, we always just mention those because we've got people coming on all the time who don't understand exactly how we do what we do. And it's important to understand the basis of our analytics and data. A few key slides just to sort of set the juices flowing. Then some questions and answers. I've got a number of questions and answers already submitted via the blog and through other channels as well. But of course, I also have the ability to be able to take the questions live in the stream, and that's the whole point about this this live stream and the ability to ask questions as we go. So that's what I hope we will end up doing. I think it will be a really interesting conversation. So much has happened in the last few days, hard to catch up. And then there'll be a sign off. I'm expecting to finish about 9:30, maybe run over a little bit tonight given the number of questions. And if for any reason I don't get through all the questions that I've got, what I'll do is I'll make a separate show and answer those questions after that. So in terms of the house rules, this is pretty important. Please understand this is not financial advice. I'm not a qualified financial advisor. I'm talking in general terms. I don't know your specific situations. So as a result of that, it's just not feasible to take this as financial advice. This is just my general observations based on my analysis and modeling. But, you know, I think there are some insights that we can share nevertheless. Secondly, please play nice in the chat room. No racial slurs. We have had in the past just a couple of people who've been a little naughty. We do actively moderate the stream as best we can. If there are people who really are, right out there, we really want to sort of discourage that. The point is there are so many great people who share their views and, we can have great discussions without needing to revert to racial slurs. So I'd ask you please just to respect that. Now, this is, of course, as at the 21st of May, 2019. If you're watching this down the track, you'll know whether I was right, whether I was wrong. You know, I always put my reputation on the line with these things, so it'll be interesting to see how these play out. And if you want to get my attention, please use Walk the World. There are so many conversations going on. I can't necessarily cover them all. And what that means is that if you use the app Walk the World, you've got a greater chance of getting my attention and me answering it. And if you don't get me the first time, ask the question again and I'll try and come back and cover it off. And there is now Super Chat enabled. And just to explain, this is partly because it gives you another opportunity to get noticed and get your question up there. It also allows us potentially to generate just a little bit of additional revenue. DFA has become quite an expensive beast as we've extended the reach of our capabilities and all the stuff we do. Every dollar that we get from the DFO channel goes back into making new content. There's no profit in it at all. It is purely just to help cover the costs. So if you like to help to donate and just keep us alive, Super Chat is now available. A number of people recommended last time I did this, so we're experimenting, see how it goes. Okay, so just in terms of the core model, briefly, this is something which I think I've mentioned many times, most people will know, but look, we do customer surveys, 52,000 surveys. We have data from other sources, public sources, as well as industry information. We put that into our core market model, that's our core modeling, and that then effectively leads on to be able to do our analytics. But we are talking all the time based on information about real households, so this is not a theoretical conversation, this is real actual stuff. And I think that does make a difference to our perspectives. The other thing is we can slice and dice the data all sorts of different ways, across the country, across segments, you know, all sorts of different dimensions. We don't have the same capability in New Zealand yet, although we are thinking about whether there's a way of doing it there. But of course, we do have Joe over in New Zealand, who's great at picking up some of the vibes over there and trying to make the information relevant to that particular area too. So I'm just going now to flick over to the information that's coming in through our slides, and this will just give you a bit of a flavour of some of the things that are going on at the moment. Firstly, the latest jobs data was mixed, of course. In fact, what happened there is that unemployment is actually looking as though it's going to rise, and that's significant, of course, because what it does mean is that the momentum in the economy looks as though it's beginning to get a bit weaker. And frankly, that's one of the things that I think you're going to hear quite a lot of me talking today, which is that the economy from all sorts of dimensions is looking quite wobbly. And it sort of helps to explain why we're starting to get now the unnatural acts, the stimulation of the economy through the Reserve Bank and through other mechanisms. But employment is one to watch, as you'll see in a second as we discuss the next trends. RBA minutes came out today, and essentially the minutes said a couple of really important things. The first is that they are watching the unemployment rate. If unemployment does begin to move up, they will definitely cut the cash rate. And they actually said that they thought that unemployment would have to be lower to be able to actually get inflation to where they want it within their 2-3% band, which means that if we see the continued upping of unemployment over the next little while, there will be a cash rate cut. And that's pretty clear from the minutes. And then the Governor Phil Lowe spoke today in Brisbane and went through this in more detail. And one of the things that he basically said is that there is an expectation that income will grow. And I picked up this chart because this just amazed me. This is basically where the information is currently on disposable income growth. It's sitting at around 2%. But their forecast, look at this, their forecast is it's going up above 4% and then sitting above 4% within the next 12 months. And I find that a pretty amazing statement. And I don't think it's realistic. So I have a view that the Reserve Bank is being overly optimistic even now. Then they do make the point in this chart that if the unemployment rate does not move lower, then there are various options, including monetary easing, additional fiscal support, spending on infrastructure, and other levers that they've got. Of course, they can do zero interest rates and below, and quantitative easing, all that sort of stuff. What I think this is also saying is that just relying on the cash rate is probably not going to be sufficient to solve the problem. But I still think the Reserve Bank is pretty much way off. And if you want a bit more information on that, this is the budget forecasting. I showed this slide a month ago, but it's just amazing. They keep getting the wages growth forecast wrong. They're always over-optimistic, and the result is that they're always off-key. So my own view is that the economic scenarios that they're looking at are way more positive than I think the reality is. Okay, just in terms of APRA, of course, I did a post earlier today going through this in detail. APRA's announced that they're going to remove the serviceability floor at 7% and will effectively give ADIs flexibility to be able to set their own floors. Now, the floor, of course, was the rate at which the repayments were assessed. So never mind what the mortgage interest rate was, it was the repayment rate was on 7%. They're also, though, going to lift the band between the rate of the mortgage and the band at which they assess it. So it now goes up from 2 or 2.25 to 2.5%. So APRA is arguing that they give a bit more buffer. It's not clear yet whether that is based off the publicly available mortgage rate or whether that's based off the deal rate, in other words, when a particular mortgage is actually issued. I suspect the latter, but we'll have to wait and see. And they've sort of basically also made the clarification that above the 2.5% is not relevant anymore. What this is about making it easier to lend. And, you know, just to give you a bit of a sense, if there's a 50 basis point change in that serviceability rate, then there's about a 6% increase in theory, the value of the mortgage that you'll be able to get. However, of course, they are still insisting on the other serviceability calculations, looking at income and looking at expenditure. And those dimensions are still there. So it doesn't necessarily mean that this is something which is going to open the doors and basically drive a whole bunch of new lending, but it is going to make it a little easier to get a mortgage for some people. And they're basically saying that these changes provide more flexibility and will give the ADIs more room to move the banks, in other words, ADIs. APRA then went on to say it doesn't actually lessen their focus on sound lending standards. Well, you know, I could beg to differ on that. I think they have actually basically walked this back now, which is a bit of a concern. And APRA basically is removing its 7% service floor. UBS said this materially reduces downside risk for housing, but is unlikely to reflate or stop RBA cutting. Now, that's interesting because some other analyst today said, well, if that happens from APRA, then the Reserve Bank will need to cut. And other people, particularly even the property sector, have basically said, right, this marks the march of property again. So effectively, you know, all bets are off now, and we're going to see significant momentum in the market again. I don't believe that to be the case. I think there might be some, at the margin, improvement. But, you know, we're going to see more unnatural acts ahead, in my view, because what everybody is concerned about, Reserve Bank, government, is that the economy doesn't continue to tank and that house prices don't continue to fall. But frankly, I think this is a little bit of sand in the wind when it comes to seeing what's really going on at the moment, in my view. Okay, and just to give you a sense of that, mortgage arrears are up again. This is from the S&P Global Ratings today. So across the country, there were rises in most states. The spin has gone up to 1.51%. But significantly, New South Wales recorded the largest year-on-year increase in arrears at 0.22%, followed by Victoria at 0.18% and Queensland at 0.16%. Those are the major states. And, you know, the arrears in Western Australia is well over 3%, but the arrears in New South Wales and in Victoria and in Queensland are also ticking up too. This is a big deal because this shows you that ahead we're going to have significantly more issues, I think, and it's pretty consistent with everything else that I've seen. Now, in terms of credit growth, it's worth also underscoring that credit is growing, but the flow is really very different now. So in fact, over the last year, the rate of growth is down for investment mortgages 22%, for owner-occupied 13%, for all households 15%, and for business it's down as well. So the rate of change of credit is easing. And that's a critical thing because effectively this is all about what I call the credit impulse. It's the rate of change of credit. If that continues to slide down, house prices will continue to fall. If it reverses, house prices may start to level out or rise. And it's also worth looking at net new loan flows. This is from the ABS data. And owner-occupied loan flows, so these are new loans coming in, are down 13% over the last year. Investment loans down 22% over the last year. Personal lending down 14.8% over the last year. All household lending down 15.7%. And businesses down 1.6%. The point here is that these new loan flows are definitely easing up. And you can see it pretty much across the board. So you can understand why it is that now the Reserve Bank and the government are a bit twitchy about all of this stuff. So on average, total down 9.1% over the last year. Now, another piece of information which is worth looking at is our household financial confidence. This is from the DFA material. So the index, this is looking at how confident people are about their finances. The index continues to go into negative territory. It's lower than it's ever been. And across all of our three wealth segments, by the way, 100 is neutral, so anything below that is negative. Free affluence, those without mortgages, they're below 100% now for the first time. Those renting are slightly more positive, although that's all relative because they're down at the bottom there at 80. So they've come up slightly. And those with mortgages are more concerned. So there is a bunch of issues in terms of households, and they talk to me about their incomes under pressure, the cost of living rising, the debt that they've got being a concern, and all of those factors which suggest to me that we've got issues in the economy quite widely at the moment. And then, of course, mortgage stress, which I report on a regular basis, 31.7% of households, that's more than a million now, are in difficulty from a cash flow basis. And it's not just the battlers, as you might expect. Even more affluent households are beginning to struggle, particularly those with investment loans and owner-occupied loans, and particularly those with interest-only loans that are now switching to principal interest loans. So it's quite a big deal. And I'm sorry, I should go back and say, of course, remember that household debt to income is 189.6. That's very, very high, one of the highest around the world. And on the debt to GDP ratio, we're, you know, only behind Switzerland. So we've got massive amounts of debt in the system. And that's why I'm very concerned about the Reserve Bank and APRA basically saying, okay, we're going to do some more of this. We're going to let the debt bomb get even bigger. It's a big deal. Okay, just to finish off that, the funding rates are easier, so down 20.5 basis points on about a year ago. It's interesting to see that's partly to do with what's happened in the US, and it's partly to do with the revised confidence levels here in Australia. Of course, the stock market went to all-time highs today. The banks are up 10% over 2 days, but the dollar, of course, is down, and that is going to have an impact on funding going forward. So there are a lot of pressures on banks as well. The net interest margins were very bad if you look at the last report round. So the banks are still struggling, and what they're tending to do is to use very cheap loans to attract new borrowers in, but there's very little evidence that they're going to transfer those lower rates to existing borrowers. And my argument would be, even if the Reserve Bank does cut, as I think they probably will, maybe even as quickly as next month, that doesn't actually mean it will follow through to all mortgage holders. And just, you know, to be quite clear, prices are still falling. This is the CoreLogic series for the last year, down more than 12% now annually on average. This, of course, masks some variations. In some places, it's down 25-28%. In other places, it's down just a few percent. Victoria, just slightly behind Melbourne. Brisbane, not too bad, but some falls. Adelaide holding its own at the moment. Tasmania, of course, also up a little, but Perth, you know, sliding 9% or so down. And of course, Perth is down 18% from its last peak, because this fall has been there for quite a long time. And the average fall is now 10%. So it'll be very interesting to see whether these change given the new circumstance with regard to lending and other factors in the new government, or whether home price continues to fall. And we'll come back to that shortly, because it'll be quite interesting to discuss the scenarios now. And on the scenarios, we have the output from our core market model driving our scenarios. It's worth saying, I think, that the scenarios as yet are not updated with new household confidence or mortgage stress data. It won't be updated until the beginning of next month. So we're using data effectively before the election and before APRA's announcements. So these are provisional results. They will change again as we get more information coming in. So the scenarios, as I keep saying, are just a way of exploring what's going on. None of the scenarios may turn out to be right. Things change, but at least it gives you a bit of a flavour as to how I'm thinking about it. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that it's quite useful, I think, sometimes to have a little bit of a sense of how some of these things could play out, and specifically what the, you know, levers may be, and how this may translate into, for example, home prices and losses to the banks. All of that stuff, I think, is quite useful. But as with all these things, it's just my opinion. So we have basically our normal framework where we look at different scenarios. We look at things like the cash rate, unemployment rate, mortgage stress, bank losses, where home prices will be over the next 2 or 3 years, the sorts of things that I call unnatural acts. In other words, what will they try to do to stop it? And some sort of probability. And then we go through business as usual, things suddenly get better, not yet doomsday, Armageddon, which is Ireland 2.0 and Iceland 2.0. There is a video you can watch which actually goes into some detail on each of these scenarios. I haven't got time to go through all of that today. So this is the business usual. I've taken the RBA rate down now, unemployment rate down as well, and mortgage stress up from last time, and the losses up, simply because, of course, the Reserve Bank is now essentially saying that things are not as rosy as they were, although they're still predicting, you know, GDP growth close to 3% in a year or two. I think that's probably highly unlikely given some of the other things that are going on internationally. The next one, this is where I've updated the things that make it better. I think the Reserve Bank could cut as low as 0.5% over this time frame. The unemployment rate will continue to rise. Mortgage stress will continue to rise. Home prices in this scenario could be down 15 to 20% peak to trough on average. In some places more, in some places less. And you'll see easing credit rules. Yeah, we've seen some of that. Fiscal stimulus, well, the tax cuts that were promised maybe later, but they're likely to come at some point. And I've given this now a 15% probability rather than a 10% previously, because of the actions that APRA has taken and because of the fact that the new government has come back in. So that's why that's now gone up to 15%. The next one is not yet doomsday, so that's where the Reserve Bank takes rates way down, just slightly into positive territory, but only slightly. So this is now very much at the sort of close to zero bounds. Unemployment will continue to rise. Mortgage stress will be around the same or perhaps a little higher than 36, but it's going to be at the point where it really starts to bite. Bank losses are going to be higher. Home prices now down here about 20 to 30% from peak to trough. And in this scenario, one bank will not be able to survive. We need a bailout or a bail-in or something to be able to actually survive or restructure. And that's got a 50% probability now. So I've taken it down from 70% to 50% because I think that the risks now have broadened and spread into some of the other scenarios. Then we can look at Armageddon or Ireland 2.0. Here now we're close to zero or below. The Reserve Bank basically is using all its ammo, quantitative easing and all that sort of stuff. Unemployment rate continues to rise, the mortgage stress continues to rise, the bank losses continue to rise as well. And here, home prices still could be in the 30 to 45% thing. And in bail-in and bail-out and QE2 and all those sorts of things. The point about this is in the context of an international crisis. So it could be the US trade wars, it could be Brexit, it could be maybe something to do with China or all combination of those, of course. I personally now am very worried about the trade wars. I think, as I discussed at the weekend and the information that I gave there through our Property Imperative Weekly, the trade wars look to me to be getting very, very serious. And as a result of that, everyone will get crushed in the crossfire, effectively, and that could have a very significant impact on us. And then the last scenario, which is effectively if we don't essentially bail the banks out and we allow the banks to fail, unlikely, but it's still vaguely possible, rates will be zero and well below, but the unemployment rate will be very high, mortgage stress will be astronomical, the losses will be remarkably high, and home prices could be way, way down. And the worrying thing now is here, that comes out now at 6% probability rather than 3% last time. So there is more chance that the bailouts won't work and that banks will continue to struggle. And of course, Iceland, if you look at what happened there, Iceland basically didn't bail out the banks. They basically let the banks fail and then swept up the mess afterwards. So that's the worst case scenario. Only got a 6% weighting, but it's still something, you know, to consider in the scheme of things. My own central case is still 20 to 30% peak to trough. And I still think that we're going to see very low interest rates. I think the Reserve Bank will cut probably next month and probably later in the year, or July and August or something like that, and more next year. But as Phil Lowe said in the conversation today, in his presentation, what he said was that actually, as you get sort of rates lower and lower, the impact of rate cuts are less and less. And that's the point, really. So far as I can see, there is very little likelihood of the impact of rate cuts working their way through the system, which is a big deal. So there you go. That's essentially the start of the conversation. Now we can start moving into the really exciting part, which is the Q&A. And the thing about the Q&A is it very much is led by what the Q&A is saying, and basically what's here. So I'm going to go up to have a look and see what's going on and take some of the questions there. I've got lots of questions also in my back pocket if we don't find any. But hopefully there will be some good questions that I can discuss. Just going down. Okay. Gee, there are so many people. I didn't watch the 7 News report on Merrifield Estate DIY, so I don't know really what you're talking about there, unfortunately. Okay. Right. Okay, so Ray... Ray Dubb says, when would be a safe and ideal time to buy for first-time buyers in Sydney? Well, look, I don't think that prices are going to suddenly magically bounce back, right? We know that there's a lot of property for sale. We know that there are a relatively small number of buyers out there at the moment. And we know that in the next few months, we're going to see a lot of property investors trying to sell. There will probably be a little bit of an ironing out of the bump, the fall, a little bit of a bump and then another fall. Now, I think that's going to be a bit of a fool's bump. In other words, it will be a dead cat bounce a little bit. And people will be persuaded probably to buy into that. And of course, the government offered incentives, you know, the new first-time buyer grants from January next year to try and encourage people to come in. But, you know, if you are going to be buying in with limited equity into a market which is likely to fall, I still think you can do better later. I could be totally wrong. It could be that prices suddenly start roaring away. But if you think about it, we know that income is still under pressure. We know that the cost of living are beginning to rise, continuing to rise. We know that the banks are applying tighter underwriting standards, not just the 7% or 7.25% buffer, but they're looking at rigorous analysis of expenditure down to a granular level. APRA hasn't changed that. And so it's still going to be quite difficult for people to be able to actually get the mortgage that they might want. I think borrowing power, which is on some cases now down 40%, may come back a little, but nevertheless, it will still be quite tough. So my expectation is that prices are not going to start recovering very soon. So unless you've got a burning need to buy now because you need to find somewhere to live, for example, I still think the rental route for a period of time is going to make more sense because rentals are continuing to slide, particularly in Melbourne and Sydney. And therefore, you know, you can potentially continue to save up, get a bigger deposit and buy later. So I don't think this is the end of the price fall. That's my own view. Could be wrong, but that's how I read it at the moment. Okay, there's no try. Please explain bank losses in basis points. Yeah, so this is the proportion of the bank's mortgage book that might be effectively defaulted and go bad. So it's the losses they make, right? And basis point is a smaller measure than a percent, because effectively it's it's just a small proportion. So it's a way of trying to give a sense of the relative size of the portfolio. And just to give you a bit of feel, 1% is 100 basis. Okay. Lots of talk about putting money into gold and Bitcoin to avoid the bail-in. What about bonds? That's from Obda88. Yeah. Very good question. I'll come back to that in a second. I just want to acknowledge Fly So Good on your super chat today. Thank you very much. Really appreciate that. fifth scenario, talking about some of the other things that are going on. Yes, very interesting. Okay, let's go back to avoid bail. Yeah, so there are various schools of thought about what to do. How do you protect the assets that you may have, right? And so some people are saying buy gold. And the idea there is you buy gold because essentially the value of gold is linked to something physical. Although, of course, gold is priced through buying and selling through exchanges. And some people would argue that the gold price is manipulated to an extent, greater or lesser extent. Bitcoin, of course, well, you know, there's been a run up. There was at 3,000, it's now up to 7,000, 8,000, it's come down. It's, you know, highly speculative, but people are actually thinking that it might be secure because it's not actually controlled by anybody particularly. But then we know that there have been various exchanges that have been broken into, and we know that the movements in Bitcoin are very unpredictable. So it's not a particularly safe bet. Bonds might be, depends on whether you're talking about corporate bonds or government bonds, right? Government bonds, in theory, because they are backed by the government, should always be there, and you know they should always be paying their coupons. Corporate bonds that often pay higher are under the somewhat similar arrangements, except they're more risky. So it depends on the type of bond that you're looking at. I know quite a few people have actually moved into bonds and out of bank deposits because they are concerned about the implications of bail-in. The thing to understand is that there is no simple, safe alternative, right? Pretty much any type of investment has risks attached. And the question you've got to ask yourself is, what is the relative risks versus the returns versus what could go wrong? Because, you know, if you hold physical gold and somebody comes and nicks it from you, then you've lost everything. If you're in Bitcoin and Bitcoin crashes, you could lose a lot because there's not much in there or other than the digital things that go on behind the scenes. And, you know, nobody quite knows what the true value of Bitcoin is or isn't and what it's related to at the moment. There are people, of course, who think that Bitcoin is a replacement for gold, but I've yet to be convinced on that. So no easy, simple answers, I'm afraid. But maybe the thing to do is to spread the risks a little bit. Spread the risk across multiple banks, spread the risk across multiple types of investment assets if you are looking to protect. If you're looking to try and speculate to make, a mozza in the process, different story. And, you know, there's perhaps a reason to think that, well, you know, Bitcoin could do it again. Might not. Highly speculative. Gold, I think, is probably more certain in terms of where the pricing is going, but even there, it's not completely clear. So this is a big question. Can't really give you a full answer, but that would be my sort of thinking on it. Okay, what else have we got? Whew, too many questions. What about peer-to-peer lending like RateSetter? This is from Dreams Oz. Good question. Yeah, P2P is quite interesting because basically what they're doing there is spreading the risk between a group of people with money to invest and a group of lenders who actually are borrowers who want to borrow, and they sort of match them up, and there's a little bit of a structure around it where there is some spreading of the risk. Now, what I'd say with the peer-to-peer is you need to find a peer-to-peer that does spread the risks. What you don't want to do is have a one-to-one match between somebody with money giving it to somebody who wants to borrow. That's highly risky. But if you've got one of the peer-to-peer lenders that basically spreads the risks across multiple lenders, actually, you know, it looks pretty good. The sorts of returns that I've seen from peer-to-peer lenders are actually quite good if you're an investor. If you are actually the right type of investor, you have to be, qualified to be able to invest because there are risks attached to it. You have to be somebody with sufficient assets to prove that you are effectively a professional investor, generally. If you are a borrower, you may well find that your loan is actually a little cheaper. May not, but it can be. And they do actually have quite good risk management processes. So I think it's worth looking at. I've always believed that peer-to-peer lending would develop quite quickly. And it has, of course, in some other markets, like in the US and in the UK, less so in Australia. But even now, there are some doing it here. And both in the commercial sector and now in the mortgage sector, of course, as well. Okay, let's have a look. What's the shortest duration government bonds we can buy in Australia? That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I'll try and find out. And if I find out, I'll put it in the comments below. Okay, J88 says, what will cause households to continue to leverage up? Yeah, well, good question. I think there are three things. Firstly, there is the sense that I could miss the boat. And if prices are going to go up, I want to buy in now because, you know, later things will be more expensive. That's the first one. The second one is that all of the noise from the media and from the real estate sector are encouraging people to go back into real estate. And so some people will be convinced by that. And remember that if you're a seller, you only need one bigger fool to buy the property off you, right? So that's the way the market works. So, you know, there will be people who will use any easing in the market conditions to get shot of property, specifically if it's a less good quality property, you know, maybe an investment property, a unit somewhere that's not performing that well. People will try to get out if there is a little bit of a movement. The third one is, it amazes me, but it's still true, that a lot of people are still absolutely convinced that property can only go up. Despite what you've seen, all the evidence I've shown you tonight, property prices, they say, can only go up. And Joe Wilkes and I did a post a few weeks ago on this whole question of the capital gains fallacy, right? The point is, property doesn't always have to go up. It can go down. And the falls can be quite significant. And of course, if you start seeing property prices falling, then effectively it's the borrower, not the bank, who takes the risk initially. So if you've got a 20% equity in a property and 80% mortgage, and the property prices drop 20%, guess what? You have no equity in the property. The bank still has the 80%. So it's highly risky, highly leveraged. And yet, a lot of people still think that property is the way to go. That's been fed to us for at least 20 odd years. I think that we need to think harder about what property is about. I've said quite a few times, I'll say it again, property is not really predominantly an investment. It is more about somewhere to live. And what I think about with property is that if it makes sense from somewhere to live, buy it, enjoy it. But if you're thinking of property as an investment tool, we're not going to see a similar scenario as happened through the 90s and 2000s, in my view. That was an aberration. That was unusual. And with tighter lending and the other things that we're seeing at the moment, I think it's highly unlikely. And bear this in mind too, that the last two times that things got into difficulty, the Reserve Bank cut rates significantly in 2010 and 2013. There is very little wriggle room now. So they don't have the capacity to fire the market again as they did previously. And I think that's actually quite an important point to make, because it does mean that effectively the scenario that we had potentially will not play out the same way again. Now, I know that's hard for some people to accept, because, people have seen property prices rise, and many people are sitting on, large equity thanks to the property prices that have risen for a long period of time. But it may not happen again. And as property prices go down, the equity that they've got will continue to dissipate. So that's a big deal. My own view is those are some of the drivers. Okay, what else have we got? Okay, this is from Biber Anti-Bullying. Please tell us how to find out more about banks' foreign funding. Which companies are providing it exactly and how much? Very good question. Hard to do. There is very little public information about the details of bank funding. There's a little bit in the annual accounts, but not very much. They'll sort of share some basic information. It is almost impossible to decode the overall funding. What we do know is that on average, the banks, the major banks, have somewhere between 30 and 40% of their funding from overseas. And that will be mixed between long-term and short-term funding, bonds, and for example, 90-day cycle as well. So they're having to continually refresh that funding cycle to be able to actually fund their books. A lot of the smaller banks have not used the foreign channels so much, so they tend to have less reliance on it. You can look at the ratio of deposits to other types of funds, but there's very little detailed information as to who precisely is funding the banks. What I do know from my own research is that quite a lot of the funding is coming from international superannuation funds from around the world, wealth management funds from around the world, hedge funds, all sorts of those sorts of people who are actually buying into the banks here, because the yields on bank funding here in Australia are still quite high, despite the fact that bond rates in the US are actually higher now than here. So that's one reason why I have a theory that as the Reserve Bank tax rates lower, we're going to find it harder and harder for the banks to be able to get the funding internationally. So I can't give you a more complete picture than that, I'm afraid. There's No Try said, I left school in the 90s recession. My kids are about to leave school just when I expect the next recession. Any thoughts on employment opportunities for the next recession? Yes. It's really tough, isn't it? I guess the thinking that I've got is that the future for society is going to be very much based around, I think, innovation and digital things. So I think that some of those areas is where some of the growth that will be. I have a sort of fairly fixed view on this. Australia's economy is very narrowly based at the moment. You know, basically we dig out iron ore and coal and what have you, and we sell it overseas. We don't do much in the way of added value. A lot of our economy is supported by very high iron ore prices. If in fact we get into a recession, that's going to disappear quite quickly. So we need to think about some of the other industries and the other sort of types of opportunities that may exist, rather than perhaps those base functions. I'd also overlay another thought, and that is that with the drought that's there at the moment and likely to continue, agricultural sector is also going to struggle too. So the opportunities for growth and for new things, I think, will be aligned around digital and some of those other things. It requires a different skill set, requires a different education set, of course. But it is really tough. And I speak to quite a few young people as I go around doing what I do. And many of them are really quite concerned about what's going on. And some are even saying, maybe I should be looking overseas because I can't necessarily see a really bright future here in Australia, which is a disgrace, frankly. And it's really down to poor policy over two decades. Excuse me, I'm just going to take a quick drink here. Okay. Yes, thank you very much. Brownie 003, 1% equals 100 basis points. You're right. Thank you for that. I had a mental block. I know. Yes, so that's exactly right. So 100 basis points equals 1%. Appreciate that. Thank you. Okay, what else have we got? What are some currencies worth investigating to spread the risk of the falling Aussie dollar? That's from Farisal. Good question. Well, in the short term, the Aussie dollar is looking as though it's going to be quite strong. And, you can argue, I think, that the trade wars and those sorts of things, in the short term at least, will probably support the US dollar. But there are some signs that the US dollar is also getting a little bit into difficulty. Clearly, China's got issues. Its growth rate is easing. They're doing a lot of stimulus at the moment to try and help the economy through. They're pulling money back from international sources back into China to try and support the local economy there. And of course, in Europe, we've got Brexit and a lot of the countries there are in difficulty. So, if I were to sort of think of it in the round, the US dollar in the short term is probably worth exploring, but be cautious, because I do think that more and more people are beginning to suggest that within the next year or two, the US dollar might begin to tank, the US economy might begin to move into recession. We've had the Trump bump thanks to the tax cuts and everything else. But in fact, if you look at the last quarter, the results from corporations were quite a lot stronger than people expected. The Fed, of course, has changed their tune a little bit and looked more willing to do more QE if they need to. And if they were to do that, then that would support the economy longer, despite the fact that it would increase debt again. So, at the moment, I guess, from what I can see, the US dollar is probably worth a look. Okay. Let's go down to see what else we've got. Have I missed any here? Okay, Gavin's saying, best short or position to profit from this downtrend position? Short the bank, stock market, or other instruments, and then go up when the economy retracts. Yeah, it's interesting. There are people who've taken shorts on the bank over quite a long period of time. There are people who have actually shorted against the property sector, and there are people who've shorted against the Aussie dollar. Of those three, I believe that the Aussie dollar is the one that's going to definitely fall further. We're at 68 or thereabouts tonight. It's going to be around 65, I think, in the next few months, and probably lower still, because the fundamentals of the economy here are looking quite weak. And that means, I think, that we're going to probably find some issues going ahead. Let me just do this. There's no try today. Thank you very much. Appreciate that contribution. Thank you so much. And Matt Groves today. Thank you. Financial education is non-existent in Australia. You're doing a great thing, mate. Thanks a lot. Thank you, Matt. I really appreciate that. Yeah, I believe that education, financial education, is absolutely critical to be able to see what's going on. The fact is that very few people really get what finance is and how it works. There's very little education done in schools. There's very little education done later in life. There's a lot of marketing spin. There's a lot of spiel about buy, 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 debt, debt, debt's good. But people need to understand debt ultimately has to be repaid, or you take it to your grave, I suppose. And there are people who actually now have a strategy of saying, I'm just going to load myself up with debt. I'll pay the interest as I can through my life, and I'll die with it. Now, some people might choose to do that. Banks, of course, love people who pay interest. That's how they make all their money. And so the more debt that's out there, the more the financial system gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's really what we've seen, an explosion in debt, an explosion in all of those things, right? Debt's the problem. Okay, Wiser 3754, what's your thought on graphene? Interesting. There is a post which I did with Tony Lacantro, who's, we'll put it up in the next hour or two, talking about some alternative strategies in terms of, you know, what sectors might be worth exploring if you give up on the banking sector or whatever. Tony's got some particular views. I have a personal view that some of the innovation sectors are worth exploring. There are some quite interesting things going on there, but of course it's high risk, right? It's very speculative, so some will not take off, some will. But I think it's worth looking at some of those alternatives. I'm a great believer in Australia needs to be a more innovative country. We need to be spending more time and effort and investment in new things and exploring effectively a whole bunch of things that at the moment just don't seem to get enough airplay. The R&D budget and tax breaks are very low here in Australia as well. So we have to broaden our economy. We have to start thinking about some of the new alternatives. And I do believe that being innovative in some of those angles will provide investment opportunities as well as other things too. Okay, let's have a look. El Porno, today, regards from New Zealand. Thank you so much. Really appreciate that. Thank you. It really does make a difference, those people who are actually helping to support us. Thank you so much. Okay. So Neil said, I knew almost nothing about finance and property except from the spruiking mainstream. That was until I started watching you. Thanks, Martin. Thank you so much. Look, if I'm doing anything at all to help raise education, raise awareness, I'm not necessarily going to tell people what to do, because I think actually you can start getting to the point of understanding enough to make your own more sensible decisions. But I'm trying to provide people with the toolkit to be able to help make better decisions financially and avoid some of the pitfalls. The advice that I basically give people when I've got the opportunity informally is to say, remember that debt has to be repaid, that more debt is not necessarily better, that high interest rates will often cost you an arm and a leg, and if the returns are too good to be true, they are too good to be true. So those are some of the things that I come to. Okay, what else have we got here? Let's have a look. Phoenix, thank you, appreciate it. Today we're going to end up with too many todays at this rate. Thank you, it's really good. Okay, hang on, Martin. Mortgage debt, doesn't it get passed on to the next of kin? Well, interesting question about that. The estate, of course, still has the debt. It doesn't get extinguished when you die. But of course, if you've got massive debts and you've got a small estate, it is extinguished. And that's what some people are actually doing. They're deliberately, effectively running up big big debts. So effectively, they service it, but that's all. Not a strategy that I would recommend personally, I don't have debt. I haven't had debt for a long, long time. I remember when I paid off my credit card bill the last time, which was about a good number of years ago, I swore that I would never, ever use debt again. So I'm not the sort of person that the banks really like, because I'm not worth anything to them, because they can't flog me products and they can't give me more loans. But, that's the ideal. And I often say to people, if you are thinking about buying, sometimes if you're going to buy property, don't buy the biggest that you can afford. Be a little bit more conservative. And, that gives you a bit more wriggle room, and it gives you the opportunity to be able to manage it more effectively. So, I know that's unpopular, because, everybody wants to buy the four bedroom plus and the double garage and all the bells and whistles, and then, of course, all the high tech to put inside it. But, you know, that consumer approach, that consumer-driven approach, is what effectively is driving our economy. Just so you know, two-thirds of the economy in the US is consumer consumption. Here, it's just about 60%, but it's dying at the moment because people aren't spending as much, right? So everybody out there is trying to sell you stuff, because essentially that's how the economy is designed to work now. But, you know, frankly, I think we've got to the point where probably we've got stuff and too much stuff. And, you know, what I'm perhaps saying is that maybe there's a new set of values that need to come in to be able to actually give a better balance into life. But there you go. I'm getting philosophical here. I'm sorry about that. Okay, what else have we got? From the big fellow, the New York Stock Exchange will be introducing digital currency trading next year. Do you think this will affect the digital markets, especially as the main markets collapse? Yes, I think that's interesting. So there is now a series of signs that in the US in particular, digital currencies could become more mainstream. And some of the investment banks are beginning to offer facilities connected to it. So as the depth of those markets increase, they become more mainstream. They could indeed begin to take on more of their own momentum. Of course, the question is, will that be essentially like Bitcoin, where it's distributed? Or will countries start bringing in digital currencies like a digital Aussie dollar? Now, there is a school of thought that says that eventually central banks will need to bring in the digital currency alternative, simply because they can't effectively let all the economy go off into the Bitcoin world or the other distributed ledger currencies. So that's how it's going to play out. But yeah, as more major players get involved in here, we're going to see the same speculation as in other parts of the market. However, we're going to see people taking positions and manipulating the market even more. So it's going to become less transparent and less easy for punters to be able to operate in those markets. And of course, there are institutions with massive computer systems and the ability to trade very, very quickly, and therefore they will always be ahead of the curve, and they will be looking for the other side of the trade all the time to be able to make money. And so people, I think, have to be very careful here, because as these markets get more developed, more sophisticated, precisely the same things will happen as happened in the other capital markets. There'll be more derivatives, there'll be more machine-driven trading, all of that stuff. And even today, if you look at the way that Bitcoin behaves, when there's a fall in Bitcoin, it's reinforced by all the computer trading that's actually linked to the movements in prices. And so nobody quite knows how many of the trades are actually legitimate and how many of them are just triggered by computer talking to each other. That's the way the markets work these days. Computer trading is a very large proportion of the total market. People don't understand that, but that's the way it works. And whilst people claim that this is market efficiency, the truth is that those with the biggest guns, in other words, the biggest computers, closest to the exchanges, can actually win out, and all the poor punters like you and me who trade perhaps stocks and shares on the normal stock exchange are always going to come out second best. Okay, Cognitive Roo says, yes, innovation. Yeah, it's very interesting there. There's a lot of innovation in agriculture in Australia. I've been amazed at some of the things that I've seen, things like using drones and remote sensing. There is a lot that could be done, I think, there to be able to actually take that further as well. So very interesting point there. Okay, what else have I got here? Talk about value capture for the audience, says UOTM8. I'm trying to make that into some acronym, but I can't. Talk about the value capture for the audience. Now, value capture of what? I think you'll have to explain that a bit more. I don't quite get what you're getting at there. So sorry, please explain. Okay, I haven't got to any of the written questions because there's so many questions on the screen. So just for those who sent the questions in, don't panic. If I don't cover them tonight, and it's 8:58, so it might be a bit unlikely, I will do a separate show and I'll go through the questions and I'll give you some answers as a separate show. Okay, what else? Yes, DIY, yes, true on crypto, thanks, yep. Audrey says, Martin, do you watch Billions? I do, actually. I'm quite fun. I worked in capital markets years ago, right? I was actually in the early days of the development in capital markets, and I was amazed at some of the cultural norms that were there amongst the traders and that amongst those who were fixated on making money. And I ultimately got to the point where I realized that the people who were actually out to make the money, you know, weren't actually necessarily good for the broader community or for humanity. They were out for their own ends. And that method and that way of thinking has really gone wide into the financial sector, right? The financial sector is about maximizing the returns in the financial sector. What I've said several times is we need to try and get back to a more balanced way, seeing the finance sector as an enabler, as a facilitator of, you know, creating opportunities for people to do things rather than end in itself. Now, the problem now is we've got so much of the whole economy wrapped up in the finance sector. You know, a good proportion of the stock exchange is actually finance. A good proportion of dividends, about 40% of dividends, comes from the finance sector. And what that means is that we're now locked into this, you know, death grip, where effectively the finance sector has got so big that it really has got to the point where it pretty much invades everything. So my own view is that sort of native greed and, you know, all that sort of stuff that I saw in the capital markets has spread over more broadly into the finance sector now, not just here in Australia, but around the world. And that's one of the reasons why I've said several times that there has to be at some point be a reset to put finance back in its box. But, you know, the Royal Commission didn't do it. The Senate inquiry on bank separation didn't do it. So there's no chance of anything happening in the near term. So we're in for another round, I'm afraid, and more of the same. But what I believe is that individuals can make a difference by being a bit more cautious and careful about the way they engage with finance. Get more intelligence around it, knowledge, and understand it, so that effectively you don't not just caught, you know, caught flowing down the river. You actually can understand what's going on. That's my thought, anyway. So, value capture. I still don't know what value capture is. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. Let's have a look. Open banking. This is from Gen C. Will there be a game? Will it be game changing? It could be, you know. Open banking is really interesting, right? Because in the UK, it was brought in about a year earlier than here. Open banking basically allows you as an individual to share your financial information with from one organization, finance information organization, to another organization to allow them to be able to run analysis on the data to be able to offer you alternatives. So in theory, small players like fintech players could potentially offer you alternatives. The question is, will they? And in the UK, where open banking has been running, it's been a damn squib, because there have been very few organizations that have the capability to be able to really create innovative alternatives from the mainstream. Now, that may be early days, maybe it'll be later. So my view is that there will be an opportunity to share information, and that's good because it means you as an individual can effectively own it and control it a bit more, whereas previously the banks had that information and used it for their own benefit only. But it really depends on whether we're going to see innovation from finance firms and from fintechs to be able to offer new and innovative financial services. And just to give you a bit of a flavour, fintechs who've been operating, for example, in the SME sector, right, are offering loans to small and medium enterprises. And that may sound good, but when you actually look at those loans, they're costing more than could be got from the main banks. They're actually more complex and sometimes to deal with. And so the promise and the reality isn't always the same. I fear that we could be going the same way again, where open banking effectively promises a lot but delivers very little. But we'll see. Okay, Matthew says short-term predictions for Sydney, Melbourne in the next 6 months. Okay. Now, it's worth saying, of course, that things have changed in the last couple of days with the new election, re-election of the coalition, and now APRA. However, my own view is we've got a lot of property investors who are really up against it. We've got a lot of people trying to sell land that they bought previously. There are a lot of sellers, and we know that there's a lot of supply of property on the market now. And we know that there is a lot of property being built now in Sydney and Melbourne. And we know that international investors have pretty much faded away, and there is a small pool of first-time buyers. there's quite a large pool of down traders who want to try and sell to be able to release equity. So from a supply and demand perspective, we've got a lot of people trying to sell, a smaller pool of people wanting to buy, able to buy, and willing to buy. On that basis, my own view is that both Sydney and Melbourne will see further home price falls over the next 6 months. The rate of those falls may be a little bit interesting. I expect to see a little bit of a sort of a sideways for a little while, but then a further fall later in the year. Depends a little bit on whether the banks really open the throttles or not in terms of these lending standards, but they still have to deal with the affordability side of it in terms of income and expenditure, and all those income and expenditure categories that are now there. And the other thing, the other unknown, is the HEM. So there's the case between ASIC and Westpac presented last week. The judge is going to come back with a result. If ASIC wins and HEM is basically proven to be not an effective tool in terms of, or totally appropriate tool in terms of responsible lending, that will really put the kibosh on things further. Prices will fall further. If ASIC loses the case and Westpac wins, it means that HEM will be used a bit more, which means that there might be a little freer. But ASIC has said that they're going to tighten the HEM anyway, or tighten the rules around benchmarks if they lose. And the other point there is that if Westpac wins, then the class actions around responsible lending will disappear, because effectively the court will have proved that HEM was sufficient. So all of those factors are in the mix. But I think that in Sydney and Melbourne, price will fall. Units are falling further. It also does depend where you look. If you look in the outer regions, outer suburbs, that's where the maximum prices are falling. They're already down 25% in places. Units are down 30% in places. Some of the high-rise development areas where perhaps there's suspect construction, I'm thinking of flammable materials as well, they're down 30 to 35%. Look at Ryde in Sydney here, right there. That's one of the areas that really is being hit very badly. Closer into the centres of town, houses in really good places with relatively good plots, and even apartments that are well appointed, close in, good amenities, will hold their value more. So it does rather depend on where you buy and what you buy. But the bog standard, print them and build them high investment unit, they will continue to fall pretty much regardless. Remember, we've got another 100,000 to 200,000 being built, big supply. There isn't enough demand coming in, either from migration or from other people, property investors. So that's going to be the weak part of the market, in my view. Okay, let's have a look. This is from Dreams 01. What will per capita recession do to Australia? Do we not have as long... Hang on, I can't read that. What will per capita recession do to Australia? Do we not have as long as the population grows? Okay. So the point of there, what you're getting at is the GDP is growing because of the population growth, right? One reason why I'm expecting population to be encouraged rather than decouraged, more migration coming in, because it's a way of keeping the illusion of growth. But the per capita measures, which tells you that productivity is actually going backwards, not going forwards, is the critical one. And what that means basically is that we are being less efficient, as a unit of production, if you want to use GDP as a measure of production or efficiency. And so in real growth terms, we're going backwards. Now, I expect that we will actually end up with real GDP also going backwards. But it does depend on the iron ore price, because the iron ore price is really high at the moment. A large proportion of our GDP is made up of the proceeds from iron ore and from other resources. That's just about supporting us at the moment. If you were to strip that out, then we've got very little growth. The business sector is not investing that hard at the moment. The only thing that's really supporting it, other than the resource sector, is government spending on infrastructure. So that's the other thing I expect to see. I expect to see more infrastructure investments over the next 1 to 2 years to try and keep the GDP number up. Of course, there's a broader question, is GDP a good measure of anything in particular? My own view is that GDP is actually a pretty bad measure of real productive output or anything. And I think there should be other measures, but GDP is the one that's used around the world. So not surprised, it's also being used here. Okay, what else have we got? Value capture is seen in Northwest Metro. Okay. Right, so I think what you're talking about here is the idea of you put in infrastructure like a rail link, and then the value of the land goes up around it. People buy the land beforehand, sit on it, and basically make, you know, an investment over time. I think that's what you're talking about. Yeah, there's some of that. There's certainly some of that around. And the fact of the matter is that truth is that in a downturn, it's those new outer areas that often actually struggle the most. We're seeing it now. So if you look over in Western Sydney, or even if you look at around some of the areas of Auckland that Joe Wilkes focuses on, some of those areas are the first ones to struggle. So it's not necessarily true that it always goes up. And we know now that land prices out west in some areas are now half of what they were 18 months ago. So there is potential there, but it's not always followed through. And yet, of course, if you look at what happens, you know, a lot of local authorities are, you know, offering this. A lot of people are buying plots on spec, then building something and then trying to flog it. The flip story about building property, of course, is one we've covered several times again with Joe. Not necessarily always sustainable in a market where there is too much supply, where effectively prices are sliding, where there are fewer buyers coming into the market. So could be tricky, but I think it's something which you know, people will still, I think, pursue. Okay, what else have we got? Sean says, will I be doing a review on the final episode of Games of Thrones? I must let you into a secret. I have not watched one single episode of Game of Thrones, I'm afraid. Sorry about that. Been too busy doing my own videos. So I noticed that somebody said, well, I wonder what the shows will be doing now. I dropped it at session 5, somebody says. Okay. Where can we get a reliable price per square meter for each suburb, says Josh? A good question. Very tough to get. SQM Research does some stuff there, if you've looked at their site. The point, of course, there is that some of their data is a little bit interesting. But no, it is quite tough. And of course, the prices do change. J88 says, is Christopher Joy the smartest, most accurate forecaster in modern history? Well, I'll leave you to talk about that. John Adams and Chris, of course, had that big debate, and Chris basically argued that it's about repayment capability. If people can repay their loans, there's no reason why mortgage lending can't continue to rise. He did concede that if there was an international crisis, there could be a crash. My own perspective, for what it's worth, is that whilst ability to service a mortgage is part of the story, actually, if you look at all the data, people are less able today to service those mortgages because they're bigger than they were and because their incomes are flat. You see that in the mortgage stress data, you see that in the RBA data. That's the first point. Second point is there is a limit to how much debt the system can support. And whilst the Reserve Bank has said consistently they don't know what that limit is and don't actually, I think, believe that debt's important. You know, if you look at some of their recent work, they didn't even include debt in their thinking in terms of the models as to how the economy worked, which is amazing. My own view is there's a point at which the amount of debt in the system is so great that it really becomes like lead in the saddlebag. And the ability of people to keep on borrowing more and more and more, which is the credit impulse, which is what's required to drive home prices higher, just runs out of smoke. That's the situation that we're in at the moment, which is why I argue that the credit impulse is unlikely to return to positive territory anytime soon, simply because we've reached maximum debt. There's a limit to how much we can actually, as a society, deal with. Now, of course, rates are very low, so repayments are a little easier, but mortgage stress is more than 1 million households at these low interest rates. It's remarkable. You know, if I go back to 2007, 2008, 2009 and 2010, we had quite a few people households in stress, but they were with mortgage rates significantly higher. So we've got a much more adverse situation here now, and yet the total household debt to income is higher than it's been. So we are at the point where I think this whole mechanism of debt is probably going to run out of smoke. So yeah, I'm not sure about Christopher. I mean, I think he's got some interesting points of view. He is, of course, very interested in the mortgage-backed securities and quite often takes positions as well. So we'll see what he says there. He also did, I think, suggest that there were going to be high levels of defaults. I agree with him on that. Okay, thoughts on EFT investing? This is from Cat of Nine Tails. Cat of Nine Tails, very good. I like that one. Yeah, depends how you go in, on what basis. I think, you know, it's not generic. There are lots of different flavors, right? Different flavors, different types of securities. I know people have done reasonably well. I know people have lost their shirts. So I would say go in with great caution. And in the current environment, where the investment dynamics are changing so quickly, it's quite awkward. Remember that, you know, volatility for traders can be your friend. But for every upside of volatility, there's a downside. There has to be a buyer for every seller, a seller for every buyer. And what that means is that our people who are effectively losing money through the EFT trading, so every time somebody makes money, somebody else loses money. That's the problem. And if you're not careful, you can be on the wrong side of the trade. And because of the way that the trading mechanisms work and the fact that quite often you don't actually necessarily have the same information as the most sophisticated traders, you can often be second best. So a bit risky. Be cautious. Okay, what else? 9:16. Chappie's Kitchen, EFT, you don't really own it. That's probably right. Whereas Predator Carrot says EFTs are great. Yeah, you know, they can be. I just a bit concerned about it. Okay. What else have we got? Joseph Wilkes. Shared equity, developers retaining an interest. Buy half, rent half. Miss a few payments, it will get added on later. Lose a job, payment holiday. Obviously, is going to get very unnatural. Yep, good point, Joe. Of course, the shared equity scheme that was announced as part of the election campaign is a great example of that, right? So basically, you've got the proportion between, let's say, 80% and 95% government backed now. But of course, somebody else is owning part of your property, right? Firstly, and the idea is that you eventually will pay it out. Once the value goes up, what happens if the value goes down? You know, that's the thing that people have forgotten to think about. So it really can be quite a risky proposition. Charles Ponzi. I don't know what all the fuss is about. Seems like sound economic management to me. I don't think thank you for that. Yeah, well, we'll see. I'm sorry, I don't agree it's sound economic management. We've got this debt thing, the debt bomb is ticking away. Global debt, of course, as well. You know, never been so much debt in the system. There is a theoretical limit, I think, to how much debt we can have. Trouble is, as we keep going around the QE cycle, we just build more debt and more debt and more debt. Asset bubbles get bigger and bigger and bigger. And there will be a point at which this whole thing just implodes in some way, which, you know, may not happen immediately. I suspect we're going to see another cycle of QE from the Fed in due course. Europe's already doing it. Japan's doing it. Switzerland's doing it. So we'll see. Okay, what else have we got? Okay. This is from Gen C. Do you have data on Illawarra price drops? Yep. Okay, so in the Illawarra, prices on average are around down 7.5% from the last peak. Units are down more. Varies a little bit, but if I look around the Wollongong area, some of those new price high-rise units there are down more than 10%. If I look at some of the houses rather than apartments, like in places like, for example, further up the coast from Thirroul here, so Ostermere and places like that, they haven't moved down quite as far. But if you go down towards Corrimal, if you go down towards Wollongong and around there, a lot of those places are actually down quite a lot. What's also interesting is that the supply of property for sale is much higher than it was, and the number of transactions which are being closed is also dropping. So my own view is prices in the Illawarra will fall further. Same, I think, by the way, for Newcastle, somewhat similar scenario. Daniel White says, how would you feel about a plot twist, interest rates going up 50 basis points next month? Whew. Very unlikely, I have to say. But, you know, remember that until quite recently, the Reserve Bank kept saying the next move in interest rates will be up. You know, they were pretty confident about it. You know, inflation was going to be in the 2-3% band. The GDP number was going to look pretty good. Employment was going to be very, very good. And, interest rates were going to go up. It's only been in the last month or so that the Reserve Bank has finally capitulated on the interest rate moves. I have to say, I think it's unlikely that rates will go up. But think about the implications of rates going down. If rates continue to go down, right, that will have an impact on the currency. If the currency continues to go down, as I think it will, we're going to start importing inflation. And we could actually start seeing inflation begin to start moving quite smartly up. If that happens, the question then is, will they have to lift interest rates? And it's not inconceivable that we see the exchange rate continue to drop, they sacrifice the dollar, we import inflation, then they have to put interest rates up. And of course, one scenario is that we end up with sort of hyperinflation. We end up with effectively a devalued currency and very high levels of interest rates. It's unlikely in the short term, but certainly people need to understand the implications of the sacrificing the dollar, which is what they're doing. And it could mean that ultimately rates go the other way. Cameron, thank you very much. Good to see you on the live stream. Well done. I'll ignore the rest of your comment there. J88, do you think the Fed might continue to hold steady or consider raising? Well, you know, the Fed's actually changed its position every time it changed its underwear, right? So end of last year, they were definitely going to continue to take rates higher. They were going to actually do quantitative tightening. They were going to try and put rates up to normal. Then, you know, this year, when the stock markets in the US crashed at the turn of the year, they changed their tune and said, oh, okay, in that case, we'll keep rates lower for longer. And if necessary, we'll do more quantitative easing. And then a couple of months ago, they sort of went, well, you know, we'll actually watch and see. So they're patient at the moment. It's really tough to say because there are two sets of indicators pulling in two different directions, right? The first direction is the direction that says corporate debt in the US is way too high and it's going to end in tears. The yield curve inversion between the long term and short term is signaling recession, and household consumption is coming off a little bit. Right. The other side of it is the last reporting rounds were that actually a lot of firms were reporting better results than they expected. But the sleeper is the trade situation. If the trade wars really do take off, then the Fed will have to cut. If the trade wars are a phony war and they get fixed quite quickly, then they may not have to. It's that simple. Okay, I've got a few more comments here. What's that one? Somebody's saying they're an hour behind on from the live stream, but they like what I'm saying. Great, good to see that. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Okay, that's El Porno. Thank you, and of course today. Okay. Now this is one I should want to take. Can you explain why the banks are so leveraged into derivatives and why this is a risk to the economy with house price falls? Sure. So just to explain, derivatives are effectively bets on movements of interest rates or commodities or exchange rates, right? And they were used initially to provide some level of protection for companies. For example, if they were trading or if they had a transaction that they needed to do, so they could actually lock it in. Now, what's happened now is that derivatives have become way more complicated, a very large part of the financial system. There's trillions and trillions of dollars out there. Probably one of the biggest sets of risks is that these are a lot of sort of particular contracts between multiple financial parties, all offset against other financial parties, so it's a little bit like a heap, right? Now, a lot of banks are involved in derivatives trading because if they are actually taking a position and the market moves in their favor, they can close out their position and report a profit. And so the trading in derivatives and taking positions is a generating income, right? Now that income then is reported as real true income for the banks, despite the fact that a lot of the derivatives exposures are actually off balance sheet rather than on balance sheet, so you're never quite sure how much exposure they've got. Now, the problem is if you are a bank and you have in your bank a capital markets division where you're trading derivatives and you have a retail division where you've got mortgages and deposits, but you're all under one roof, if the deposit sector blows up, sorry, if the derivative sector blows up and you have huge losses, as happened, for example, in 2007 in the US, then the only way that you can cover those losses is by using the assets from the retail bank. So what that means is that a bank could effectively crash or have to pull on deposits or even use bail-in and those sorts of techniques to survive. So by having derivatives as part of the overall structure of banking, you actually expose the retail banking to risk, which is why we believe that banking separation is so critical. You should be separating retail banking, you know, mortgages and deposits and all that sort of stuff, from the speculative trades of derivatives. But the fact of the matter is that many banks are making more money from derivatives trading than they are from core retail banking, particularly now. So that's why the major banks want to continue to trade derivatives. Okay. Ideal bank, that's an oxymoron if there was one, says Akali. Yes. Well, you know, there is a place for finance, there's a place for banks. The problem is that we've actually allowed it to get out of hand. It's now effectively ruling the roost. It's driving policy, it's driving government behavior, it's driving, you know, so much. It's excluding a lot of things that we should be doing as a result. It's got too big for its own boots. That's simply the problem. Joseph, I was, you took the words out of my mouth. If you want to know more about some of these things, right, go and have a look at the DFA archives. There are posts on how derivatives works. There are posts on capital and how that works. We've done a lot. There's more than 500 shows in the archives. Worth having a look. You'll find some interesting stuff. There are interviews with Steve Keen, for example, on, you know, the credit impulse. There are interviews with people on the other side, on the MMT, on the MMT tech camp, so from the economic stuff. There's various other things there. There's advice from financial advisors and from mortgage brokers. Quite a lot of stuff, hopefully, which is useful. Shepherd's Kitchen says, Westpac and NAB had bailed out, borrowed from the US Fed after the GFC. Yep, correct. That's the thing that people, a lot of people don't understand. We were rescued, partly because China did a huge stimulus in 2007, but also we got help from the Fed. So a number of our banks got bailed out. Without that, things would have been very, very nasty here. And that's one of the reasons why I keep talking about the low levels of capital that banks have here in Australia, even now, that the banks are not marking to market the risks in their loan portfolios that they should be, because probably prices have fallen. We have high risks in our banking system, and yet, you know, everyone says we've got highly powerful regulators who are doing great things. I wish I could be so positive as that. I'm afraid that, our banking system is a bit of a house of cards. Okay. Well, it's 9:28. So firstly, my apologies. I have not been able to do the Q&As that I actually had here, which is a little bit of a concern. But, you know, it's one of those things. I'm afraid that sometimes we get so caught up in the discussion. I hope that you found the discussion useful. There are a few slides I'll just close with, and then I'll just come back and have a look one last time at the slides. So just a few things to cover off. The first is that if I can just highlight the fact that we do run a Patreon program. We have 207 people who actually are through there through our Patreon program. You get a lot of other interesting insights as well behind the scenes. I sometimes put up full interviews where only a minute gets shown on the main TV. So go and look at Patreon. There are different tiers. You'll find, I think, that quite useful. And for those who have signed up via Patreon, thank you very much for your support there. It really is appreciated. You can also make one-off donations via PayPal. Some people are doing that. Thank you very much. It really is appreciated. It all helps, as I said earlier on, to cover some of the costs of doing this stuff. I'm spending more and more of my time now making content. I love doing it. I love all the interviews that I do, but I'm doing less consulting. So effectively, I'm now more reliant on the Patreon and by the PayPal and, you know, the adverts revenue from YouTube to cover the costs of doing what we do. Every dollar we get gets back into more content. DFA blog, of course, I always mention that, contains a whole lot more data. Have a look at that. Lots and lots of different articles. If you want to know more about bail-in, if you want to know more about derivatives, it's really, really worthwhile. Joshua, thank you very much. Really appreciated today. Thank you. And just to close out, a few final thoughts in terms of what's there. What a difference a day makes. That's where we discussed the stock market movements yesterday and some of the implications. That's a big deal. The credit impulse under the microscope, that gets into the detail of the data around what's happened with regard to the credit impulse. Watch the latest update on that, and we'll do that every month because it's so critical. There's a very good, I set myself, discussion about housing policy in the vacuum. In other words, why is it that housing is the way it is? Some really important policy discussions there. The weekly property imperatives, I do them, as you know, on a Saturday. They're very, very popular. One of the things I would ask is that I used to do podcasts as well. In other words, audio versions, but I noticed that almost nobody was using the audio version. So if anybody's interested in me resurrecting the audio versions of any of our shows, can do it. But I stopped doing it because there was no interest that I could see, either directly on the DFA channel or via the iTunes, which is where they were previously. So let me know if you think that should change. There's a post that I'd recommend, did with Joe Wilkes, on the mythology of capital gains. And that's really interesting because we talked then about, you know, all the expectations that people have and the reality. So that's worth looking at. That was very popular. And finally, I did a show with Tony LeCantro the other day, going back to the future, we talked about after the election. I've got a show with Chris Bates coming up on his thoughts post the election, and also one with Edwin Almeida. They'll be coming up in the next couple of days. So watch out for the information with regard to the whole question about the election and how this plays out. It's very interesting that all of us have some quite similar views with regard to that. James, thank you very much for that comment. Really appreciate it. Thank you. Love it. So I think that's pretty much where we're going to get to today. I'm just going to go back and have one last quick look at the comments to see whether there's anything else that needs to be addressed before I finally put the ribbons on this. Thank you very much, Chris. The material available on Patreon is exceptional. Thank you. I really appreciate that. There is a lot of good stuff there. And what I try to do is to record the long form interviews. So when somebody comes from, you know, Channel 9 or whatever and interview me, they'll only pick two or three sentences. But the whole interview is up there. And there's other background things as well. So people can get some good information. I also post the mortgage stress data there early as well, for example, as well. Okay, I listened to the podcast that they were slow to upload. Okay, yeah, thank you very much for that, Jay. Interesting. So what I tried to do was to put the podcasts as a link in the YouTube channel to be able to actually give people the choice. So, you know, if there is interest from the community for me to do the audio versions, I'll do that. But it seems to me that we've got a lot of interest in the YouTube, and of course because I do YouTube every day, it's very current. I'm really focusing now on getting breaking news out as quickly as I can, because I think that's probably the most significant contribution that I can make. So okay, yes, okay, thoughts, questions here about China and the Belt and Road initiatives. I don't really have time to discuss that now. I will do a post on that. I think it's a good question. It's a really important question. And the fact of the matter is that story of China and how they're actually influencing is very interesting, concerning, and you know, different people have different points of view, but one I think that we'll get to. Yeah, so I've got about 6 pages of questions what I haven't answered tonight. All those people who sent me through them beforehand, trust me, I will get to them. I will record an additional show in the next day or two, and I'll make sure all of those up. Aaron said, could you make it today? Compilation? Yeah, maybe I should. And Roger said, I like your drum beat music better. Oh dear. Well, you can never win on that one. The fact of the matter is, I got quite a lot of people saying it'd be nice to have a change, so I tried to change. I might from time to time go back to the drum roll, but hopefully the newly composed stuff is also quite reasonable. So I want to say thank you very much tonight for all of your support. All of your questions. We've had more than 800 people at one time on the stream, in fact nearly 900, so that's a record, pretty remarkable. If I haven't answered your specific question, I do apologize. If you would like me to follow up, send me a message either via the YouTube or send me via the DFA blog. You can always send me a message directly on the DFA blog. I will try and answer them. I do read all the comments on the YouTube. I do try and comment where I can. There are lots of different people ask me lots of questions. Thor, thank you so much today. Appreciate that. Thank you. Watch for next month. There will be another show in about a month's time. There'll be live updates every day via the DFA channel, which effectively will, be there most evenings. And I may do one or two additional live streams on specific issues, because I quite enjoy doing the live streams, and clearly if there's appetite and interest, perhaps we could do that too. But I'm not going to promise to do a live stream every day. That would kill me. So I want to say thank you all very much. Edwin, hello. Yeah, I'm not sure where Uppercut is. I'm not sure whether he's on the stream tonight. As you say, Edwin, he does need to get fit. Good to see you on the stream. So thank you all very much. Have a wonderful evening. Stay safe. Watch the finance market carefully. Don't be deceived by what the mainstream media is telling you. And we'll see you again next month. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off.